had you missed most of the week, and especially the results of the recent midterm elections, and you simply tuned into the presidential news conference that took place the next day, and that's all you had to go on, you might have thought that the president's party had actually been victorious in the last election. It was amazing to watch this whole thing transpire on TV, because the president was upbeat, he was confident, he was positive, and certainly welcomed the opportunity to work with the Congress, and if they have specific ideas, I'll be happy to work with them. And it was a reality that was different than most people's reality as to what happened, because it was actually one of the most, if not the most, well, it was the most crushing election by an incumbent president, a most crushing defeat toward an incumbent president when he's not been up for re-election himself in modern history. In fact, I think you have to go all the way back to the 30s or late 20s before you had such a crushing blow to a sitting president. And this was followed by the election of 2010, which was also kind of a, wasn't as crushing a defeat, but in the House of Congress, there were more and more Republicans added. Of course, the Republican Party has been characterized as a party of old white men. And then the funny thing about this election was that there were Republicans of every race, creed, color, gender possible that were elected, and all of them pretty much conservative Republicans as well. But the president didn't give any clue publicly that his party had suffered a major defeat. And I'm just trying to report here, right? I'm not trying to pit one party or one ideology against another, and I think you'll see why. But he had said several weeks prior to the election, I'm not on the ballot, which my wife is happy about, but my policies are. And if there's anything that election this past week showed, no matter whether the two-thirds who apparently the president was upset with because they didn't go to poll, or maybe he's thinking that all of them would have voted for his policies, but regardless, they didn't. And if these results showed anything, it's that those policies, the presidential policies for the last 6 years, which include a lot of very liberal ideas about wealth redistribution and taxing people and then, you know, giving to others of that tax money, a healthcare system run by the government, and more onerous government regulation, especially in the area of energy policy and et cetera, all these things, all of that was soundly rejected by the voters, and they basically said, we don't want any more of this. Put a stop to it, put an end to it. We've had 6 years. This is not working. There are more people than jobless, and I don't know how you feel about this, but when I look at the jobless rate and what it's reported at, you know, 6% or 5%, whatever they say, that's not the jobless rate. It's at least twice that, if not three times that, as to what is being reported, because they take out of the numbers everybody that's just so discouraged that they quit looking. And it's bad out there. I mean, it's really, really bad, which you would never know, because there's another reality that is given by the news media about how wonderful things are and how the economy is so great. It's a false illusion. And I think you probably already know that. It's been pumped up by money that has been just printed and printed and printed. They call it fiat money because it's not really backed by anything. And now we are indebted twice what we were indebted before this present president took office. We're closing in on $19 trillion in debt. In fact, the debt is greater than the gross domestic product, and that, folks, cannot go on for a very long time. Now, government interventional policies kind of prop up the economy, and maybe the saving grace is that as bad as it has been for America from a historical perspective, it's still better than many other economies in the rest of the world. So, however, all of that said, in most years when this would happen, in other words, when the party that has the presidency does not have the congressional houses of the Congress and the Senate, that would mean, as it did in 1994 when the congressional leaders came together and proposed to the American electorate, we have a policy, that we have a plan for America that we want you to vote on. And they voted for them. And when that happened to President Clinton, he was kind of conciliatory and kind of dragged into compromising with the opposing party because he didn't have the cachet that he did when he had more of his members of his party in power in Congress and the Senate. It doesn't appear, at least from what the pundits say, that that is going to be a point that will that they'll come together at this particular time. In fact, it's even been signaled by the president, and it has long been his dream to grant amnesty to millions and millions of people here who are in the United States illegally. They snuck across the border. They're here. You know, there's a million stories that are out there, and some of them are really heartbreaking, but along with all of that, it is a violation of our law. And so it doesn't appear. Now, stranger things could happen, but it doesn't appear as though there's going to be a kind of a meeting of the minds or kind of at least an acknowledgement, okay, you guys got me here. Let's compromise. Doesn't seem as though that's going to be the way it will work. Why is it all important? It's a interesting thing for a Christian to watch. You know, we could quote all the scriptures. We're not citizens of this world. We're citizens of the kingdom of God. And from that standpoint, it's important that we take a look at what's happening in our country today and in the world today, because there is one thing that a president can do when he's in this position. It hasn't happened very often, but what he can do is basically bypass in the division of powers amongst the Congress and the judicial system. He can bypass all of that and sign an executive order. An executive order is something that the president decides he wants to do. It's not implied or specified necessarily in the Constitution, but it has been used for years as a traditional thing and acknowledged that the president can sign an executive order and it has the same effect as laws that are passed by the Congress and by the Senate. This important power that he has been used often for noble purposes. In fact, one of the most famous of executive orders was signed by Abraham Lincoln. And you know what it was, the Emancipation Proclamation. Who could say anything bad about that? It freed millions of slaves at that time. And it was an important step towards the healing of the breach in our country. It didn't ever really happen in some parts of the country. You know, there's still hard feelings over that. But it was an important step forward as a civilized society. And it was a bold act that happened at that particular time. However, that particular stroke of the pen now in this time is probably to be feared because it can be utilized to issue amnesty to millions of people who are here illegally. Now, whether that's going to happen or not, we can't really know yet. We just don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But regardless of that, it's an interesting part to watch within our government. The other very important power that the executive branch of our government has is the power of the veto. So now that there's a majority of Republicans in Congress and in the Senate, they can begin to either defund or repeal things and sign them into law. And of course, it goes nowhere if the president is going to sign it. But they can do it, and some think that that's the way to go, and maybe they'll get enough individuals on the other side of the aisle to vote with them to override what the veto is. And that can be done, too. That's the trump card that the Congress has, is they can have an override of that, and they can force it into law. And or they can impeach the president if he does something that is so drastic to our country. A lot of people don't think that that will happen. That's only happened twice in our history, and it happened in the 20th century, as many of you know. The expectation by many is that there will be laws that will reverse many of the things that have happened that voters have said they don't want any more of. They want to defund a national health care system because, believe me, that is something that is not going to work, or it's not going to work very well. I mean, all things work if they're forced into law, but it's not going to be good as alternatives would be. So the next 2 years are going to be interesting to watch. And as I began to think about these things that I'm talking about, a lot of things that I'm going to choose not to speak about in terms of what happens within the government, it made me look back over the historical sense of the United States and wonder where we have been and what has happened to us as a country. And I thought about different times in our history when things seemed to be going pretty well. And I thought back to a time that the news media at the time kind of glorified this administration. They glorified the Kennedy administration, and I knew this well when I was a little kid, and they called it a certain name. And they called it this name because it pictured an idyllic time in which there would be a beneficent king in England. And some people think it happened. Some people think it was just the mythology of the Knights of the Round Table and, you know, everybody getting along and the beneficent benefactor of a king trying to do things for his subjects and really being a servant of the subjects. And I see it being mouthed on your lips by some of you, a time called Camelot. And that's what the time of the Kennedy administration was called. And it was a fantasy because knowledge and information of those times that has been revealed, we don't need to go into detail, reveal all the skullduggery and the behind room scenes and, you know, the illegal payoffs and the corruption that was rampant in the government then. And then, you know, for a few years after the Kennedy administration, you know, there was the buildup and the escalation of something that's very important. When I was a kid, wanted to stay out of, if at all possible, and that was the Vietnam War, which by the time my number was being called, the draft had been done away with at that particular time. So that was good news for me. Probably good news for the Army as well. It wouldn't have been necessarily a great addition for me to join the Army. Any army that would have me as a soldier, I would not want to be a part of. Not really. Sure, I would have done fine in military service, but it wasn't necessary. But I began to think about all of the times in our history, and maybe if you go back to the gallant times of the Revolution, you find a lot of people that were willing to sacrifice their lives, their wealth, their estates, to ensure that our nation would remain free from the tyranny of the King of England. And, yeah, I'll grant that there's some romanticism then as well. But no matter what era you pick in our history, you're going to dig a little bit and you're going to find corruption at some level and difficulty. You can find it now. And it's really not hard to find now. I mean, it's on the front pages. I could give you the litany of all of those things. And so this idea that we are a people that are different, but it's not because necessarily of the goodness of government. It has been because of the blessings of Abraham. And virtually all of what we have experienced is the result of God pouring out his blessings as he promised on a people. And despite the fact that those people were imperfect and sometimes their leaders were largely imperfect, those blessings continued to roll and we're still there experiencing it. Now, when God, it seems as though, this is my hypothesis, it seems to me as though we have kind of willingly removed the blessings of Abraham for the last 6 years by denying some of the things that are present and, you know, kind of withholding them by governmental fiat, by decree. We'll kill this industry, the coal industry. We'll basically kill that by making regulations so encumbersome that it will be incredibly difficult for any industry to live up to those standards, and therefore they'll go out of business. In fact, that's what has happened. In fact, that was everything that prior to his campaign in 2006 that President Obama said that he wanted to achieve has basically happened. He's been very successful in implementing his agenda, which is far different from many others. I'm not trying to hurt anybody's feelings by saying this. It's just a simple fact, and all you have to do is go to Western Kentucky and West Virginia, and that's why all of those folks voted in mass, in waves, for Republicans, because they knew that, you know, the standards were just crazy. And we have, you know, probably the greatest deposits of gas, oil, gas and oil and coal combined of any country in the world. But we've kind of deprived ourselves from the utilization of those as they fully could. And but it really does seem that as we have experienced in the last few years that we have entered into an age, and maybe it will be reversed for a few years. I don't know. But again, I think it's just an interesting thing for us to look at from a certain perspective as individuals. An interesting column by Pat Buchanan entitled Things Fall Apart, not too long ago, long before the election, but it shows the difference between the can-do spirit that used to be a part of America and what the spirit and the attitude that has pervaded us in the last few years. When this writer was 3 years old, the Empire of Japan devastated battleship row of the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. Before I was seven, General MacArthur was in an office in Tokyo overlooking the Imperial Palace, dictating to a shattered Japan. We wrote their constitution and handed it to them after declaring victory in the Pacific, and basically that is the constitution that has governed Japan since that time. In 1956, President Eisenhower, impressed by the Autobahn he had seen in Hitler's Reich, ordered a U.S. interstate highway system constructed, tying America together, one of the great public works projects in all history. Within a decade, the system was on its way to completion. In 1961, John F. Kennedy said the United States, which had been beaten into space by Nikita Khrushchev's Soviet Union, would put a man on the moon and return him to Earth within the decade. And in July 1969, most of us would remember where we were. To some of you younger folks, yes, we did have TVs in those days. They were about the size of this. Maybe the screen was about the size of this iPad as I'm reading this news column. And they were like 500 pounds, the smallest one. But we did have TVs, and it was black and white. Well, there was at least the one I was looking at that time when, you know, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I saw that happen as a 17-year-old kid. It was amazing. President Nixon welcomed the astronauts home on the deck of the carrier Hornet. The author asks, whatever became of that America? Whatever became of that can-do nation? What has happened to us? This October saw the vaunted Center for Disease Control and Prevention fumbling over basic questions on how to protect Americans from an Ebola epidemic. You know, quarantine, something that we learned during the Black Ages with a bubonic plague. You know, they knew enough about science that, and actually from the Bible, that you keep those people separate if they have suspected symptoms of a disease. You don't welcome them into your world. It's pretty simple, and yet we can't even answer these small little questions. And then he cites several times in which the White House fence has been breached. People have made it into the White House, one guy with a knife recently. And then in Atlanta, somebody with a violent criminal past had a knife, was on the elevator with the president. How do these things happen? I mean, just unbelievable. And last summer, very close to home, reports that 60,000 children and young people from Central America had walked across the border into the United States, overwhelming our border patrol. He mentions the VA debacle and the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, which is just a joke. You know, people couldn't even get into the website that was created to implement this vast system. Yet 5 days in 1940, 350,000 British troops who were besieged at Dunkirk were rescued from across the channel by their countrymen in boats and yachts under the guns of the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. Such events have contributed to a collapse of confidence among Americans in the competency of their leaders and their government. Large majorities now believe America is heading downhill, that the future will not be as good as the past, that we're going in the wrong direction. And it goes on and on. Since mid-1970s, real wages of the working Americans have stagnated as we run uninterrupted trade deficits totaling more than $10 trillion. That's trade deficits, $10 trillion in trade deficits, a national debt of $19 trillion, and that surpasses our ability of what we can produce in a year. We borrow from Japan and Europe. To defend Japan and Europe, the World War II has been over for 70 years. FedEx tracks with precision millions of packages a day, but the U.S. government cannot locate and send back 12 million illegal aliens. So it just goes on and on. I won't bore you with that. But that kind of spirit may make a resurgence, by the way. It may. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. We'll just – that's why – watching what's going to happen in the next few years is going to be interesting. Laws can be overturned and repealed and done away with, and I don't know if this is going to happen, but when people are in your country, it's kind of hard to outlaw them once they have been granted legal status. And so that would be a real game changer for a country. Will it happen? We know that the Bible says that there's a time in which the alien will rise above you. And have we reached that time, or will we reach that time because of policies? We don't know yet. It is certainly a possibility. But with that as the prelude, I'd like to ask you to turn to Matthew chapter 18, because my point today is that we may wonder and think about, and we may be able to, as I've done pretty well, I think, like a lot of other people have done, is to show the absurdity of the system in which we live. And if it weren't for God's blessing, it would be – it is so overrun with corruption and incompetence that there would be no propping it up at all. I believe that God has not totally removed those blessings yet, although it may be in the process of doing so. And yet, still look at us. We have life. We have freedom. Many of those freedoms are being taken away, and we're being spied on by the government. Man, this whole room – everything that is being said here could find its way to some government official at some point, which means that I might be knocking on your door someday as I'm being chased through the night by federal agents. In Matthew chapter 18, that's scary. Not the federal agents chasing me, that I might knock on your door sometime, right? In Matthew 18, in verse 1, it says, "At that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, 'Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" You know, which one of us will be great? This was a question that was on their minds for 3.5 years. Greatness in the kingdom of heaven. Then Jesus called a little child to them, set him in the midst of them, and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me." I believe that one of the greatest lessons we can learn as we watch the society at large in good times and in bad times, one of the best lessons, one of the greatest things that we can learn is the contrast between how man governs himself and how we're all called to govern with Jesus Christ for 1,000 years. What happens in the near future of our political system or the rest of the world is not nearly as important as what you do and what I do in observing what happens and learning the lessons that God is preparing for us so that we can be ready to rule with Jesus Christ in the world tomorrow. So what are the important elements of your preparation? It's going to be very, very simple today. One basically topic, one little topic in terms of our preparation. And there's nothing, no can-do list that I can tell you how to get there and do this, 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 and you will be that. I believe God designs for each individual in his body what is necessary for them. if we're subject to God, and we are subject to God, then that we will be prepared in the right way. But it's always nice to know where God is going to take you, right? So let's turn to Isaiah chapter 3. This may, in some parts of it, may describe where we are today or a progression of things, things that happen and things that have happened for maybe some time. For behold, the Lord of hosts, takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stock and the store, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water. Now, that doesn't appear to be a prophecy that is going to be fulfilled until we're well into the prophetic game. I mean, until we begin to see a lot of other things happen as well. But it's not there now. We know that. I mean, I'm pretty much assured that most of you here today came with you had breakfast, or maybe you had a brunch, or maybe you had breakfast and lunch. I don't care. You're probably not too hungry when you got here today. So that's not happened necessarily for most of us. The mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, and the counselor and the skillful artisan. When I came into the church, and especially when I went to Ambassador College, and maybe for a reason, we had a lot of instruction on leadership and studying great leaders and seeing how they reacted during different difficult times. And we read about the MacArthurs and the Churchills, and we read of their wisdom, and we saw how they developed, and we were kind of modeling that kind of training at times, or certain elements of that training. We even wrote an article one time, you know, regarding the raising and the training of Prince Charles, how he's being trained to be a king and that sort of thing. And all of that was very noble and that sort of thing. But Prince Charles actually kind of turned out to be pretty much a putz for most of his life, let's face it. But the main thing is all of those things are good. All of those things are fine. Sorry. If you like Prince Charles, kind of a weirdo, actually. Seen him speak, and he's off in Neverland, you know. It's just very strange. But we were given instruction, which is not bad, but knowing all of the rules of leadership and all of the ideas that trained kings and all of that sort of thing, it can be good. But there's something even more important and of much greater value than that. Verse 4, I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. The people will be oppressed, and everyone by another, and everyone by his neighbor. The child will be insolent to the elder, and the base toward the honorable. Certainly possible that we have some elements of that within our present day society. We've known that for years this was happening within our world, and maybe even more so now. But all the more the need for the future real leaders to respond in a different way. Now, there was a young man in ancient Babylon, if you'll turn to the book of Daniel, that realized that there were decisions that he could make. At that young time in his life, late teenage years, as he was being groomed to serve in the king's palace and the king's court. And in Daniel chapter 1, beginning in verse 3, it shows that there was a selection process. They just didn't go by random. They had a way of identifying people that were individuals that had a lot on the ball, apparently. And they were very selective. And they chose these people. The king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had the ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. Here you get this vanquished people. Now let's take the cream of the crop. Let's bring them into Ambassador College of Babylon and teach them how to be, you know, really top-notch individuals. Let's take the best of the best, and they can add to our society. However, the Chaldeans and the Babylonians looked at it, they were going to serve the king, and they're going to have very special jobs. And a king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them. I don't know if they're to drink, supposed to be drinking wine every day. I don't know how that helps you, but I don't know, mixed with the knowledge and the food. But basically, we have looked at this as, you know, this was rejected by Daniel and his cohorts, his friends, rejected because they realized that it wouldn't really lead to anything profitable. It wouldn't give them good health, whether it was unclean food or whether it was just not healthy food, and they realized it, but it was considered delicacies by the Babylonians. We don't really know. It could have been totally unclean, but they decided to go a more natural route and more basic route, and something that, you know, kind of really, even after a while, it set them apart, as we know. Now, from among those, the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And to them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. In verse 8, it says, but Daniel purposed in his heart. This is something that every individual can do, and even every individual that is called of God can do. That is, make a determination. If you haven't thought about it, it's time to do so, but you probably have thought about it. Determine that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies. Now, this delicacies could have been just food, or it could have been a lot of other things that were available to kings at that particular time. Things that a Christian should avoid, and things that Daniel knew that he should avoid as well. Nor with the wine which he drank, therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself, and they honored that request. But he determined ahead of time that he knew what was right, and he knew what was wrong, and he knew that he would not partake of whatever that was, not just because it was a health issue, but because it was a matter of character. It was a matter of something that he was just not going to do. He was not going to defile himself. So, you know, not sure that just eating something would be something that would just defile you from a spiritual standpoint, even though eating unclean meats is not a good thing, even, you know, that it's not, and we shouldn't do it, and I don't do it, and I don't know anybody that does. It has to be more than just a matter of eating something to just defile them from a spiritual standpoint, because, you know, probably a lot of people have accidentally eaten something, a pork hot dog that they thought was a beef hot dog, or, you know, my daughter a number of months ago had some sushi. She had some, I think it was tuna, and it was tainted with something else, maybe some shellfish, and she had a severe reaction and could have gone into anaphylactic shock and that sort of thing. But, you know, she didn't commit a spiritual sin. So all of these things that are mentioned as a part of what the king offered, Daniel must have known that there was some spiritual component, not food, but something that was offered that we're not told explicitly, that was a part of the regimen of the king and what he would allow and what he would bestow, that there would be a spiritual issue here. And so he determined in advance that he wasn't going to have any part of that. And in Daniel chapter 3 and in verse 16, this very famous example of these individuals who previously had determined to themselves that we are not going to be a part of this. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, you know, we're not bowing down to that idol. It's not going to happen. And we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor we worship the gold image which you have set up. So they made a conscious decision well in advance that they were, no matter what happened, they weren't going to compromise at all. I've told you a story about meeting the sculptor of Crazy Horse, an incredible individual. Worked for Gutzon Borglum on the carving of Mount Rushmore, but they clashed. Two artists clashing. Who knew that that would happen? But he got thrown off the project. And he was just kind of hanging around Custer, South Dakota in the late 1940s. And the remaining Indian chiefs of the Sioux Nation came to him because they knew he was a great sculptor and a great artist. And they said, you know, we have some land. We have a mountain in South Dakota. It was just north of Custer, South Dakota. And we would like you to carve something that would remember the heritage of our people. And so in the late 40s, started out camping in a tent near Custer, South Dakota, near this mountain, by a stream where he caught his own fish to feed himself. He began this very modest work of carving Crazy Horse. And in 1982, we went to see him in hopes of doing an article on him and his mammoth project. The article never came about, but at any rate, we went to see him, and we're sitting around, and I'd done some research. He told us how he threw out Geraldo Rivera, which I always thought was a great story, because he was, you know, trying to do an investigative type thing, and that was kind of silly. But I'd done my research, and I'd learned that he had turned down $10 million from the federal government to help him fulfill that project and get it done more quickly. And I said, Mr. Joukowsky, you know, why did you decide to turn all that money down? It would have helped you. And he said, because I would have to compromise. And he looked at me and he said, and I was like 28 years old at the time, he said, and he's 82, and he said, so we kind of had our ages reversed, just thought of that. He said, compromise is the language of the devil. Just wow. I mean, it was with all the kind of power and conviction of someone like Herbert Armstrong, of whom he was about the same age at that time. And, you know, I got a little chill just hearing that. And I knew what he meant. And sometimes compromise is not a good thing because you're compromising your values. That's something that Daniel and his buddies would not do. They would not compromise. Okay, that gold idol, it's nothing. Hey, is it going to – why don't we just go along? It's not going to hurt anybody if we – we really in our hearts know God is God. With, you know, this gold idol, it means nothing. But Korchak Joukowsky said he made his point. Now, there are times when compromise is not a bad thing, right? Not all compromise is of the devil. I think we know that. If your wife wants to go to a steakhouse and you want to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken, neither one of those choices is bad. So to get your wife to compromise to go to the chicken place is a good thing. She should compromise, right? She should say, yes, you're the head of the household. You should do, because I am your leader. Just kidding. I like steak. Now. As long as it doesn't violate God's principles, then there's nothing wrong with compromising. And in the government today, compromise could be a good thing as long as it doesn't violate the principles of God. But so often in this life, compromise can mean compromising the values that you hold dear for a short-term gain. And that is not a good thing. Turn to Luke chapter 21. Luke 21 and verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34, we've read this for years. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighted down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass, to stand before the Son of Man. Now, I fully believe in everyone in this room having a broad understanding of prophetic events. and understanding the book of Revelation, and I have no issue. In fact, I would encourage you to do it. Study prophecy. But don't study prophecy to try to figure out what happens next. That's not the issue. Much of prophecy will be understood retrospectively. People think that they earn brownie points or, you know, have attained some spirituality by understanding when something will happen. That's not the key. The key in studying prophecy and looking at what is happening in the world is to be sobered by what is happening and not be caught off guard, but mostly to be spiritually aware of your condition and understand where you stand with God. Not to know, you know, all of the seven seals in order to be able to recite them and, you know, the third woe and the second seal and the four horsemen and the ten nations and, you know, the beast and the four great ruling powers, and all of that is great, you know, in balance. So I'm not saying forget all that, study it. But if you think that you're going to be able to accurately predict what happens in prophecy and that by that accurate prediction you're going to provide some escape or salvation for yourself, that is crazy thoughts. And it's not going to happen, because I'm sure that a lot of the end time prophecy is going to be fulfilled and we're going to say, aha, that's what that meant. We're told to watch our spiritual condition. Now, in Isaiah 11, it describes what the world is going to become, and it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be fantastic. And we rehearse this at the feast. It describes what will happen. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch that shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, and the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with a rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. That happens at his return. And righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist. And then we have all of these great, wonderful millennial themes that come to pass because of all of that. And we see what is going to happen because of Christ's intervention. The nature of animals is changed, and little children are leading around all kinds of wild animals. And, you know, goes on later in the chapter and shows how the Gentiles are going to seek him and all of that. And that's going to be the condition of the world that we rule in. And that, but the most important quality is found in Isaiah chapter 66. You know, in terms of our development now, this is more important than reading the autobiographies of great men. I'm not saying don't do that. This is more important to you and to your salvation than perhaps anything else. In Isaiah 66 and verse 1, it's, thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you can build me, and where is the place of my rest? The other day I was speaking with a colleague who was driving in New Mexico, and it was like Thursday night. Some of you may remember this if you're coming home from work. I was on the northwest side of Tucson. I was driving home. It was about 4:30, 5 o'clock. And 400 miles away from us, this person was saying, oh, wow, do you see the moon? It's beautiful. It's a big full moon. I said, no, where in the sky is it? And she said, it's in the east, dummy, where it normally is when it rises. Yeah, well, it's not here. Due to the curvature of the earth, we couldn't see the moon yet. But about 15, 20 minutes later, the moon is rising up over the Rincons and the Catalinas. And it was such a beautiful sight. It was brilliant. That moon was especially bright. It was incredible. And I thought about this scripture and about God and how great he is, and that there's no place that we could build for God that is greater than what he has created for himself. Pretty impressive, the universe and the vastness and the seemingly infinite place that we are at. For all those things my hand has made, and all those things exist, says the Lord, but on this one will I look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit, who trembles at my word. some of the most vital qualities of humility and meekness are the things that are overlooked in today's world, especially by today's leaders. And truth be told, if they were to exhibit any weakness in their, or that anything that could be attributed to any kind of weakness or attitude, they'd be eaten alive. I'm sure that when leaders get together, meekness and humility they may be, but they have to show a powerful, strong front in the world that we live in. But having someone respectful of the Word of God and of the law of God is of much greater value than all the other supposed successful leadership qualities that are identified in books on leadership. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 1, this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you, you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, that you might multiply greatly as the Lord God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And this was something that Mr. Young mentioned as quoted by the young man in his conversation with Christ. He knew the truth. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign in your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. And you shall write them on the doorsteps of your house and on your gates. If anything, rulership and leadership within a family is the most important quality that you can build. And if you're doing it with humility and with grace, then you're learning how to rule and rule with others like you with Christ. We see a contrast in Revelation 3 between the last three churches that are mentioned. And I'm not going to read it, but we see a church that Christ characterizes as a dead church. I believe that Mr. Armstrong was correct when he said that he felt that the people that he initially came into contact with, who were headquartered originally in Stanbury, Missouri, in the 18th and the 19th and the 20th centuries, he believed that they were the Sardis Church, and I fully agree with that assessment. They don't like to hear that, but that's basically the conclusion that I have come to as well. The Philadelphian era of the Church of God is something, is the only era that God has nothing against. And then the last era that is mentioned, may all of these may all be existing coexisting with one another at the time of Christ's return. That's entirely true. But of the Laodicean church, not really excited about anything, not really any zeal, not really any conviction. And, you know, there may be various reasons, and I've talked about that. But there is a direct contrast. They're all God's people, and salvation will be provided, although with some complications. But it really appears that if you hone in and take a look at the Philadelphian era, how can you have brotherly love without humility and meekness? How can you have the gift of prophecy and the ability to discern those things without being humbled by the events that they portray, that are portrayed by those prophecies? How can you fail to acknowledge that we are on the very edge of the fulfillment of these things without a humble and contrite spirit? Those things, in terms of leadership, are of much greater value than almost anything like decisiveness and organizational ability. How much can God add to you when you become a spirit being in all those perhaps temporal qualities? Hebrews 2:9 says, "We see Jesus, who is made a little lower than the angels, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. The perfect example of meekness and humility, and that is the thing that he tried to drive into the minds of his disciples in his physical ministry, and they finally got it as the years rolled by. And you see a great deal in the New Testament about the qualities of meekness and humility and being a servant as he was. The next few years are going to be interesting to watch on a national scene. And we really can't have any prejudice one way or another. I hope no one interprets anything I've said as being prejudicial in any way or favorable in one sense to another. There are policies and there are ideas that are correct and those that are wrong. There's no doubt about that. But more so from the standpoint of, as bystanders sitting on the national scene, what is really most important is all of us that God has called should be evaluating ourselves and building the qualities of humility and meekness within our character that will enable us to teach and guide, serve, and help others with Christ.